The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the May-June 2023 issue. We begin with our cover story, Life as We Know It. The more we learn about life on Earth, the more one thing becomes clear. It's far stranger than we ever imagined. Organisms often behave in ways that clash with the typical rules of biology, sparking mysteries and lessons about the true nature of life and death. From the tallest tree to the tiniest bacterium, all living things share some common ground. They're all made of cells. They all take in and use energy from their environment. They're all capable of reproducing themselves, and they all grow and evolve. If something doesn't tick all those boxes, it's not considered a living organism. However, the world is teeming with minuscule things that aren't quite alive, but don't seem to be fully inert either. This microscopic menagerie can make scientists pause and disagree over how we even define life in the first place. Viruses, for instance, are clearly capable of evolving. The COVID-19 pandemic's variant-led waves demonstrate the ever-changing mutability of SARS-CoV-2. But Nobel-winning immunologist Peter Medawar and author Jean Medawar wrote in 1977 that a virus is, quote, simply a piece of bad news wrapped up in a protein. While they can evolve, viruses lack other key traits present in even simple life forms like bacteria, including a cellular makeup and an internal metabolism. They can mimic life, but they're not alive, says Elodie Geddon, a virologist with the National Institutes of Health. Geddon likens viruses to robots. They can't power themselves, and without an internal spark to switch them on, they're inert. To express itself and replicate, a virus must be in the right place at the right time, namely in contact with a receptive cell. Once the virus breaches a cell, it harnesses its protein and hijacks the cell's ability to replicate. Then that activates the whole rest of the process, says Geddon. There are virus proteins that get expressed, and those will bind with host proteins, and that triggers this domino effect of replicating a virus. The cell is doing the work, not the virus. While viruses can't replicate on their own, the same is true for other biological units that are in fact considered life, thus breaking the general rule. Virologist David Bella at the University of Glasgow in Scotland recalls that as a student, this inconsistency needled him. This argument that a virus can't be alive because it has to replicate inside another cell really stuck out, Bella says. Because there are lots of things that can't survive without replicating inside of another cell. The parasitic bacteria chlamydia, for instance, has to live inside a host cell. And from a broader view, we humans couldn't survive and reproduce without the many other living things in our environment, such as the plants that provide our food and the oxygen we breathe. Bella has carried this line of questioning with him throughout his career and even wrote an editorial in Microbiology Today in 2016, arguing that viruses should be considered living things. The ability to replicate and evolve is one of the most parsimonious definitions of life, he says, and viruses certainly fit the bill on both fronts. Anyone who's been infected with one of COVID's many variants can attest to viruses' capacity for evolving into ever more elusive forms. Delta and Omicron are much more contagious than the original version of SARS-CoV-2 that began circulating in humans at the end of 2019. These newer variants are the result of errors in the virus's replication process that wound up being beneficial to the virus, not to us. Within just 3 years of infecting humans, the collective iterations of SARS-CoV-2 have killed more than 6.8 million people around the world. Over the past three decades, discoveries of comparatively giant viruses, the size of some bacteria and containing DNA and more complex structures than the simple bad news wrapped in a protein model, have made the distinction between viruses and living things even blurrier. It's such a fine line with the giant viruses, says Geddon, and I think that's why it's been a debate for so long. Since viruses aren't alive to begin with, they can't really be killed, but heat or chemicals like bleach and the ubiquitous high alcohol hand sanitizer can destroy their physical structures. We are smashing them, basically, says Geddon. Other not quite alive things can't be so easily not technically killed. Some of the strangest and deadliest are prions. They're far tinier than viruses, but they pack a lot of punch. Prions are misfolded versions of a normal protein found across the mammal family. Simply being folded in the wrong shape causes neighboring proteins to do the same, in a sort of domino effect. These misfolded proteins destroy brain functions, resulting in fatal diseases like bovine spongiform encephalopathy, aka mad cow disease, and its human infecting form, Creutzfeldt-Jakob. People can get prion diseases from eating infected meat or from contamination during brain surgery or blood transfusion. These proteins can even be passed hereditarily, with rare diseases like fatal familial insomnia causing the inability to sleep and deadly dementia. Scariest of all, they remain stable in the environment for decades, waiting for an unsuspecting organism to infect. Prions are not alive by any stretch of the definition, says Mark Zabel, a prion researcher at Colorado State University. But they push the limits of how scientists understand the transmission of biological instructions. Amid all this blurriness, prions and viruses help illustrate one thing that is clear. Nature abhors a hard and fast rule. Three life-defying organisms. The world's greatest plant is a clone. At first glance, the seagrass in Western Australia's Shark Bay appears to be thousands of separate patches and meadows. But research published just last year revealed the Shark Bay seagrass, stretching over an area the size of Cincinnati, is just one individual plant, connected in many places by stems under the sand called rhizomes, and in other spots by genetic code alone. It's pretty mind-blowing, says Elizabeth Sinclair, a biologist at the University of Western Australia. When Sinclair and her colleagues analyzed the DNA of seagrass samples from different meadows across the bay, they found nearly identical genetic coding. They realized that the seagrass has been cloning itself for the past 4,500 years, resulting in the largest plant in the world, based on surface area. Grasses spread by sending out shoots called runners, Sinclair explains. You can't always see them because they might be buried, she says. But they just keep expanding, and they put down new roots, and a new shoot grows up. This creates a dizzyingly complex network. Even if the runners get severed, the two sections are still genetically identical, like when you make a cutting of a plant. The disconnected sections of the Shark Bay seagrass continue cloning themselves, resulting in a sort of thought puzzle. Even if the seagrass meadows lose their physical connection, does their genetic identity mean that they still count as one biological individual? And if the clonal seagrass counts as one organism, then does the same logic hold for all clones? For now, science offers more musings than answers. How tardigrades cheat death. Of all the weird tiny organisms out there, tardigrades might be the cutest. Under a microscope, what you would see is this little critter that kind of looks like either an eight-legged gummy bear or an eight-legged manatee, says Thomas Boothby, a molecular biologist at the University of Wyoming. To top it off, these lovable microanimals are known colloquially as water bears or moss piglets. Despite their cuddly appearances, tardigrades are tough. They can survive just about any sort of environmental stress that you throw at them, says Boothby. That includes the crushing pressure of the ocean floor, the DNA shredding powers of radiation, the vacuum of space, and even temperatures just 1 degree above absolute zero, the temperature at which molecular motion ceases. Scientists like Boothby are attempting to get to the bottom of tardigrades' death-defying hardiness. Boothby's lab focuses on how tardigrades can survive the evaporation of all the water in their cells by curling up and suspending their metabolic processes, essentially just hitting the pause button on life until they're reunited with water. One of the secrets that Boothby and his colleagues have found involves a special flexible protein in tardigrades that doesn't break when damaged, perhaps via freezing or drying out. What's more, when the genes create this protein are put into another organism, like a yeast or bacteria, that organism takes on the tardigrade's drying-resistant superpowers. Boothby says that tardigrade cells' ability to survive desiccation could be the key to stabilizing vaccines and pharmaceuticals so that they can be stored at room temperature instead of relying on fridges and freezers. With any luck, tardigrades' legendary durability will make it easier for humans to survive too. The secrets of immortal jellyfish. At first, the tiny Teratopsis dorni jellyfish progresses through its life cycle predictably. It matures from a free-swimming larva to a polyp stuck to the seafloor of its Mediterranean home, awaiting the next stage of its life. Eventually, it transforms into an adult medusa, trailing delicate tentacles from its bell, still only the size of a lentil. But once it's done being an adult, instead of dying, it does something extraordinary. It reverts back into a polyp. From there, it switches back and forth from polyp to medusa ad infinitum. This immunity to old age has earned T. dorni the nickname immortal jellyfish, though they can still die from infections or, say, getting slurped up by fishes. In 2022, researchers published a comparison of the genes of immortal and mortal jellyfish to see what makes the immortal one so special. They found that the immortal jellyfish had extra copies of some genes associated with the aging process, including ones relating to DNA repair. The modifications and backup copies suggest that these genes are crucial to the jellyfish's ability to rejuvenate. Maria Pascal Torner, a scientist at the Universidad de Oviedo in Spain and the study's lead author, cautions that these jellyfish aren't our ticket to immortality. However, they could give us a better understanding of healthy aging and pathologies associated with aging, such as cancer or neurodegenerative disease. In the meantime, they complicate our picture of what it means to live and die. And as Pascal Torner notes, the understanding of life, like the understanding of nature, is always complex. The tricky boundaries between one living thing and another. In 1674, Anton von Leeuwenhoek became the first person to set eyes on living cells and revealed that there's an entire microscopic world right under our noses. Sometimes literally. In 1683, when examining plaque from people's teeth, he reported finding, quote, with great wonder that in the said matter there were many very little living animalcules, very prettily a-moving. Unwittingly, he had become one of the first people in the world to document the human microbiome, millions of microbial organisms living on and in our bodies. In more recent years, scientists have discovered just how much of our bodies are made up of microbes. There are about 30 trillion human cells in your body and about 39 trillion microbial cells. By pure numbers, we are more microbe than not. These microbes, which are themselves living organisms such as bacteria, aren't just hitching a ride. They are providing key services that we can't perform on our own. For instance, take the amino acid processing microbes in our gut. Amino acids are the building blocks of proteins, and our bodies aren't capable of producing all of them that we need. But bacteria can provide access to essential amino acids. Our microbiome releases these building blocks that our body can then absorb and use for different purposes, says Holly Lutz, a postdoctoral researcher at Scripps Research in La Jolla, California. Once jailbroken by our microbiome, these amino acids are able to link together and fold into 3D protein chains that form body tissues and enzymes that carry out biochemical processes we need to survive. The microbes in our gut also contribute to our immune responses and prevent colonization by potentially harmful bacteria. They're an ecological factor that is most intimately connected to the host, and it's one that we've overlooked in many ways, says Lutz. Without these trillions of microbes, we would not survive, or at least we would fail to thrive. As this biological realm comes into view on the microscopic level, it can challenge the traditional notion of life as an individual and independent organism. It's disorienting to realize that each of us is this motile colony of cells from a lot of different places, says Ellen Clark, a philosopher who focuses on biology at the University of Leeds in England. I don't think it undermines our unity. It just means that you've got to be a bit more careful about understanding the basis of that unity. This more nuanced view of an individual organism as a discrete living unit whose existence is interwoven with other forms of life is known in biology as the holobiont concept. It has been applied not only to organisms and their microbiomes, but also to parasites that can't survive outside their hosts, to colonial organisms like corals, and even to entire ecosystems. To paraphrase the words of English poet John Donne, written half a century before Leeuwenhoek first saw his animalcules, "No man and no microbe is an island." Zombie genes and resurrected cells, the research that's redefining death. The boundary between life and death for many of us seems stark. You're either alive or you're dead, right? Turns out even when our hearts cease to pump and our brain's electrical signals fizzle out, other elements of our bodies flicker to life. New research is even finding ways to resurrect cells that have ceased to function. In 2016, scientists first published an accidental and shocking discovery. Some genes in zebrafish become active after death. What began as a novelty that rattled the scientific community has since been demonstrated in numerous studies with different animals, including humans. In 2022, researchers examining human brain tissues showed that after death, some of the genes in our brains activate. A large number of genes were shooting through the roof and growing during this simulated postmortem interval, says Jeffrey Loeb, a neurologist at the University of Illinois, Chicago, who had expected to see most of the brain's activities shutting down after a few hours. Loeb and his colleagues found that the brain's anti-inflammatory glial cells were not only coming alive, but producing these monstrous tentacles. While that might sound like something out of a horror film, Loeb points to a logical explanation. Basically, what we think they're doing is they're cleaning up, he says. If you have an injury in your brain, these are the cells that come in and remove debris. Apparently, they just don't discern between a manageable injury and deadly trauma that shuts down the body's systems. These zombie genes are a quirk of nature, a testament to how life isn't just a switch that gets flipped on or off, with every cell capitulating instantaneously. However, some researchers have found artificial ways to intervene in the process of death. Such scientific pursuits date back to at least the 1880s, when a team got a frog's heart to beat outside of its body, leading to the development of saline solutions that help patients with low blood pressure or dehydration today. In a 2022 study published in Nature, scientists took the field further, restoring some signs of life in dead pigs. The researchers achieved this by hooking up recently deceased pigs to a machine called the OrganX, which kept vital organs functioning. They then mixed the animal's blood with a fluid rich in vitamins and amino acids. The combination of OrganX and the synthetic blood helped restore circulation and even functionality to cells in the pig's brains, hearts, kidneys, and livers. This was an hour after the animals had died. David Andrejevic, a neuroscientist at the Yale School of Medicine who co-led the study, notes that the language describing what happened is important. "We did not bring pigs back to life, nor did we make zombie pigs. It's just we restored cellular function," Andrejevic says. The authors say they aren't aiming to find a cure for death, but to extend the viability of transplant organs. Essentially, their breakthrough could help provide medical treatment for the living by prolonging cell function in donated organs that need to reach faraway recipients. The implications in transplants would be huge, says Andrejevic. The archaeology of flavor. We can often tell what ancient peoples ate by studying the evidence of raw ingredients they left behind. But there's no fossil record for flavor, so how can we learn how a long-ago lunch may have tasted? When it comes to ancient foods, archaeologists can easily glean main ingredients based on butchered bones and plant remains found in cooking areas. But every chef and diner knows dietary staples don't make meals delectable or distinctive. It's flavor, rendered through spices, herbs, and culinary craft, that defines a dish. Certain flavors have come to distinguish the cuisines of different cultures, like umami in Japan or herbs de Provence in southern France. In the 1970s, cookbook author Elizabeth Rosen named this phenomenon the flavor principle. Chefs talk about this all the time, but archaeologists do not, says Christine Hasdorf, an archaeologist and professor at the University of California, Berkeley, who urges her colleagues to think more about flavor. Communities inherit not just dishes and not just meals, but they inherit flavors. Presumably, past cultures also upheld the flavor principle. Uncovering those long-ago flavors is tricky, though. Seasonings and prep methods seldom survive the way bones and botanicals do. But thanks to scholars like Hasdorf, archaeology has begun to tap into ancient flavors. This new avenue of research is revealing culinary fads and cultural ties that otherwise would be forgotten, and allowing people today to taste the past. About a decade ago, Hasdorf was planning a Bronze Age feast for archaeologists digging in the Italian countryside. Because excavations had recovered cow bones and grains, her menu featured beef and oats. But Hasdorf also sought ingredients from a villager who was familiar with the plants nibbled by locals for generations. In the woman's garden, they picked wild purslane, an herby succulent which had sprung up between orderly rows of vegetables. Added to the Bronze Age dishes, the weed delivered a tangy crunch and dose of vitamin C. Wild plants like purslane help create the unique flavorscapes of cuisines, says Hasdorf, and she believes purslane has figured into the Mediterranean flavorscape for millennia. "I would assume that people in the past would have tested everything that grows in their area," she explains. "The tart, healthy weed likely passed this test and entered the regional cuisine." Besides heightening that particular feast, the experience later inspired Hasdorf to rethink research being done halfway around the globe in Bolivia. There, on a vast plateau 2 miles above the sea, past people began settling on the shores of Lake Titicaca roughly 4,000 years ago. The ancient highlanders raised llamas, alpacas, and guinea pigs, and farmed quinoa and a rainbow of root vegetables. Preserved bits of these crops surfaced in ancient structures and trash heaps excavated by Hasdorf and colleague Maria Bruno of Dickinson College. The studies published between 2011 and 2016, the researchers also identified remains from wild species, which they concluded entered the mix not for culinary reasons, but as uninvited weeds for fodder for grazing animals. But at the same time, they observed the same weeds in meals prepared by the region's indigenous Aymara residents. The species also came up when Bruno formally interviewed locals about traditional uses of plants as part of her earlier dissertation research. And Hasdorf remembered that purslane had flavored her Bronze Age meal. In a 2020 Journal of Anthropological Archaeology paper, the archaeologists paired Aymara knowledge with their archaeological evidence to reinterpret ancient eating habits. They realized their original conclusion, assuming wild species were unwanted weeds or fodder, was perhaps misguided. Those species could have been key ingredients that transformed bland eats into cuisine. For example, today, locals punch up the flavor of stews with quihua, a minty shrub that sprouts from rocky soils at even higher elevations than Lake Titicaca. Probable quihua remains were found in some excavation pits, suggesting past lakeshore residents also hiked upslope to collect the pungent herb. The study showed flavor preferences have likely endured around Lake Titicaca for over 3,000 years, despite the region's later rule by the Inca Empire and European colonizers. While Hasdorf and Bruno uncovered past flavors with low-tech tools, other scientists have deployed cutting-edge molecular analyses, like proteomics. This method can output a list of proteins in a substance and read the molecular building blocks of those proteins, which differ by species like DNA code. Thus, proteomics can detect chemical modifications due to reactions the proteins underwent. Thanks to these three layers of information, a scientist could zap a food scrap and discover it contained, say, collagen, a muscle protein from Ovis aries, the species we know as sheep, which was barbecued, reactions that modified the protein. Anna Shevchenko, a cell biologist at the Max Planck Institute in Dresden, Germany, was with archaeological scientist Yimin Yang of the University of Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing, among the first to realize proteomics' potential in archaeological gastronomy. In the early 2000s, she was researching venomous caterpillars native to Brazil when she received an inquiry from Yang. Instead of caterpillars from Brazil, to try something which is 4,000 years old, Shevchenko recalls, we didn't say no. We like this kind of adventure. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodkey, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.